Let's bring up the...
Okay, Shkach, we're off. Tov, so Roth wanted to make a little get-together before the end of the Zman. It's been a very, very unique experience this year. I don't know why this year more than all the other 10 years that I've been in HaKotel, right? Can't be the quality of people, so I don't know. I don't know what was unique about this year. But yeah, Baruch Hashem, I say sincerely that I have a tremendous amount of gratitude to everyone here, some of the old people, some of the newcomers. And Bezrat Hashem, yeah, anything that people would like to put forward to discuss. As I said a second ago, I reserve the right to deem questions inappropriate, but that probably won't need to be, that nuclear option probably won't have to be used, I'm hoping. Yeah, Moshe, MT Shapiro,
let's go. Let's get Roth's questions first.
No, that's a question. It's Kedai to start off with that, to get that out of the way.
But I'm curious
I've been learning by Rav Asher Weiss for many, many years. In the past couple of years, I've had less of an opportunity to meet with him face to face. But I mean, ever since I was learning in the Gush, like in 2006, like this is many, many years already, I've been going to him, and I appreciate his derech halimud. He's the scion of the Hasidish lamdanim, like Sachachov, right, the Avnei Nezer, and Sanz, and all of that. Very much not brisk. Also, Rav Shabtai Rappaport, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Efrat for a number of years, while I was living in Efrat for 4 years, so I made a kesher with him, but I haven't really been in touch with him for a long time, but he's also a very, very special gadol. He's married to the granddaughter of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He actually went to America and got smicha from him after he got married and came back to Eretz Yisrael. He's a very, very, very special person. It's very kedai to look him up. Very inconspicuous. Like, he rides a bike down the street, like, doesn't wear a jacket. It's like, I think he was the Rosh Kolel in Bar Ilan for a while. I'm not sure what he's doing now. But he's a very, 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 very special Talmid Chacham. Another Rav that I'm very close to, this is the last one, in Nigla, is a Rav named Rav David Bar Chaim, who was here in Har Nof for many years, and a few years ago moved to Neve Daniel, and he runs a machon called Machon Shiloh, which is focusing on more authentic, what he would call authentic methods of Iyun, that haven't been corrupted by the endless pontification and brain somersaults that are so ubiquitous in the yeshiva world today, to put it lightly.
What?
Well, not even that, I would call the way that I would phrase it is first principles approach to halachic psak and learning makaros. So I've become much closer with him over the past three four years. So that's in Nigla. And in Nista, Rav Moshe Shapiro, as you've all heard me for sure quote a number of times, that's probably my strongest influence. And then recently, like very recently, over the past couple of months, I've become closer to a Rav in Ramot named Rav Moshe Shatz, who I was talking with Elon a little bit about him. He's a very interesting personality. He used to be a Talmud of the Rav many, many years ago and came to Eretz Yisrael, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 years ago. And now sits and researches Kabbalah all day. Very, very interesting character. So yeah, that's basically the breakdown. Yeah, Tov. You got to function as moderator over here, Noam. You got to take a more active role.
Okay. I guess the next question. I assume a lot of people are going to want to ask this: is how do you come up with the chaburas?
How do I come up with the chaburas? So the chaburas are I don't come up with them that week necessarily. I mean, these are products of like a long time of of going through Makoros and paying attention to things. A method that I found that's very, very helpful is that I try to pay attention to things that I come across in learning and make note of them and to create a network of different Makoros that are talking about a similar topic, and that will help me build something more coherent and more unified at some point. It could be that year, like years after underlining something in some Gemara, so I'll come across something in some, you know, random Maharal that talks about a similar idea, and then it'll make that connection. Also, writing things down, like having like a notebook. I just keep the notes in my phone. Like I keep like several files of notes in my phone. They're backed up, obviously, and yeah, that's a mistake you only make once. And they coalesce over time, but you have to. This is why it's important to like pay attention, while you're learning, to make sure that you're building that network of information, so that as it's progressing, you can build something that's coherent. Yeah.
Two more.
Okay.
Similar questions. The first one is, how do you amass your Torah knowledge, and how can we replicate that?
What? How do you amass Torah knowledge?
How did you amass your Torah knowledge?
Oh, I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time. I mean, I was in yeshiva before some of you guys were born, I think. Oh, I can't believe I just said that. But no, I mean, listen, the perspective. It's very, very difficult for human beings because, from an evolutionary perspective, the human mind, the primal human mind, is not built to think exponentially. What does that mean? They're not built to appreciate exponential buildup. That's something, right? Like incremental buildup, we can think of. It's easy, right? 2 + 2 = 4, plus another 2 = 6, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like that's easy to like register in your mind the significance of that progression. But exponential progression, meaning 2 + 2, next day +4, next day +8, et cetera, right? That it's hard to appreciate. Like you can think intellectually, obviously you can understand. But to appreciate the weight of such a thing, it's very, very difficult. And there are studies that prove the magnitude of this, right? That famous study that everyone says, would you rather, you know, $1,000 today or a penny times itself over time? Like that, I'm sure you've all heard that thing, right? The reason that people fail in that exam, right, or that test, so to speak, is because it's very difficult to process exponential growth, right? So Talmud Torah, really any field of excellence, but certainly Talmud Torah, because of its interconnected and network structure, it produces an incremental growth, right? So people that have been in yeshiva, you know, right, like they go to yeshiva and they're there for, you know, 5-6 years and they're learning very seriously, and they leave yeshiva and they go do whatever it is that they're going to do, they can accomplish, you know, more in the 2 or 3 hours of Seder that they have, right, than, you know, some yeshiva guy can do in a week. Why is that? Because they're geniuses? No, it's because they've developed the skills to be able to plow through something very, very quickly, and B, they have the background knowledge to be able to understand what it is that they're talking about. You have a Shana Aleph guy, or even a Shana Bet guy, right, he's learning something new. How long does it take him just to get oriented in what he's doing, right? It takes time. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes mental energy, right? It takes hours out of the day. Yeah. So someone who has that experience, someone who has a holistic knowledge of Torah, so the getting oriented takes 5 seconds, whereas someone else it takes them 5 hours. Yeah? So just practically speaking, that exponential growth ends up paying off, and you're able to invest a lot less time and produce a lot more results. But this is why I tell you, and I tell the guys this whenever opportunity I get. This is why when we're in yeshiva, it's vital, it's essential to be focusing on the most primary makoros that you can get. Right? You got to throw away the parsha sheets. You got it. I know that they're fun. I know that they're cute, but you got to throw away the parsha sheets. While you're here, you got to be focusing on the most primary things you can get your hands on. You got to pound as many Daf of Gemara as you can, as many Prakim of Rambam as you can. You got to plow. You got to plow because this is the opportunity to do it, right? Any Prakim of Tanakh, right? And yes, and Tanakh is yes, Tanakh is also important, right? But again, not to like just okay. I want to refrain from saying things that are going to sound insulting to people. I'm just going to say this as plainly as possible. When we learn, we need to make sure that the content that we're learning, and also the mefarshim that we're learning, right, are the most primary mefarshim possible. And if we need help in order to be able to get through that a little quicker, okay, fine. So make a chavrusa with a guy that's more advanced than you. That could be, right? And it'll only take a few months where you yourself are already oriented enough that you can do it independently. But again, to focus on the primary makoros, because this is the time to do it. Guys get to yeshiva, they're Shana Aleph guys, they decide, I'm going to do the Avyomi for the time that I'm in yeshiva. You could easily leave here with hundreds of daf of Gemara. Hundreds of daf of Gemara. Right? And again, those hundreds of daf of Gemara, they're not just those hundreds of daf. They now open up, right, vistas to a whole other branches of learning. Because again, you have the background knowledge, you have the orientation to be able to, right, to be able to plow through learning easier. So that's what I would say. A person has to decide what they want to do. A person says, I want to be in yeshiva for a year or two of an interesting experience, you know, strengthen my Jewish identity or something like that. That's fine. That's great. Right. But if someone says, I want to be here to build a foundation of Talmud Torah for the rest of my life, so that's a completely different goal. Yeah? So in order to do that, this is what you have to do. Right? You have to spend that time. You have to spend the 1 year, the 2 years, the 3 years maybe that you're here, right, pounding away at the Makaros. Just pounding away as much as possible. Yeah. And even if you don't finish all of Shas, it's not the goal. I'm not saying you have to finish all of Shas. I'm saying that if you make that decision for 2 or 3 years, then you will walk away with an asset that will carry through for the rest of your life. It's just as simple as that. But it's making that decision. The person has to know why it is that they're here. And if they know why they're here, then they can get something done. No. Yeah.
Well, mentioning learning Tanakh. How should the issue of the Ayin Shiva relate to learning Tanakh? With all of the stigma that exists, and what's the best way to do it? Because, again, a lot of it's very hard to... I mean, there's the easier parts, like between Yoshua and Merachim, and then after that...
Those are the easy parts now.
Seemingly. What would you suggest?
No, I'll concede. Obviously, that there are parts in Tanakh that are easier and more difficult to understand. This mitzad, like the lashon, but I mean the stories. There's a different type of difficulty with the stories of understanding the motivations of people and why they're doing what they're doing and how the outcomes are produced are I think, in my opinion, are just as difficult to understand as the poetic language of Yeshayahu or Yechezkel.
How should you go about learning both types of meaning? Is there a certain one of the four students that it's better to learn, or is there a specific Derech HaLimud that you would recommend for
Tanakh, for sure, Nach shouldn't be your primary Seder when you're in Yeshiva. I think that's just a given. But you do have to, I think it's necessary to make a time to make a set Seder for that, whether it's a half an hour a day, even 15 minutes a day, right? But to make sure that that's kavua, that you're making progress in Neviim and Ksuvim, right? You have to have that knowledge. The very first Amud of the Bavli says that this book is meant for people who, right? Like, we're assuming that the person who's reading this book has a very, very grounded knowledge in all of Kisvei HaKodesh, right? It's explicit in the first Amud of the Bavli. Yeah, like, we're not here to teach you psukim. We're here to, right, once you've gone through all the psukim, so this is like the advanced level. Yeah, so I understand that we don't necessarily all come to Gemara with our first day of Gemara Shir with Bekias and all of Neviim and Ksuvim, but still it's very, very important to be able to inculcate that. And I will say even more, the foundations of all of Machshava are found ultimately in the Neviim, right? Because why are the Neviim called the Neviim, right? Like, how many prophets were there in all of Jewish history? You know? Who learned Megillah over here, right? 1.2 million, exactly. Why? Kiflaim Kiyosim Mitzrayim, right? Exactly. So the Gemara Megillah says that there were 1,200,000 prophets in Jewish history, right? Give or take. Yeah? So why is only that the 48 Neviim made it in, right? So those 48 Neviim, it says they were relevant for all the generations. But what that means is that their message was not a message directed at an individual. It means it was tochacha for the entire Jewish people in terms of the mission of the Jewish people, right? Tochacha for the Jewish people in terms of what the Jewish people are supposed to do in the world. So the foundations of all of Machshava are found in the Neviim and Ksuvim. And unfortunately, the profound corruptions in Machshava today that we find are, in my opinion, if this is not the biggest reason, it's certainly one of the biggest reasons. It's because people are simply amaratzim. I'm sorry to be so blunt, but they're amaratzim in the Neviim. Right? They just don't know like what is the tochacha of Yeshayahu, right? What is the tochacha of Yechezkel? Like, what are the issues that they're bringing up? These things are very, and it's difficult because these things are, because a lot of these topics are very foreign to the situation of Klal Yisrael over the past many centuries, right? They're talking about the context of kings and corrupt rulers and dealing with foreign nations, right? And these things that we haven't had necessarily to deal with. So they can sound foreign, but that excuse doesn't exist today. So we really need to up the game in that respect.
One more question on that idea. You mentioned the Rambam. How should Yeshiva Bachar, besides the Rambam, build their knowledge of halacha? Like, which to Bachar, like Mishnah Berurah, Mishnah Harah, specifically?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends really there what your goal is. I mean, to go through all of Mishnah Berurah, it's a big sefer, and I would say that not all of Mishnah Berurah is really relevant lamaisa for most people. I mean, like, you know, Chelek Dalet is all of Hilchos Erevin, and like it's not really going to be so applicable. For example, right, a lot of Chelek Aleph is Hilchos Stam, right, Hilchos Safrus, which is a very narrow field of knowledge for experts. I think Chayei Adam with Nishmas Adam is very, very good because it gives the pshat, but like the Nishmas Adam it kind of, you know, like elaborates a little bit. Also, Aruch HaShulchan is very good, and it's shorter than the Mishnah Berurah, so you can cover more ground in that sense, but it also gives you a lot, it gives you a holistic view of like the whole sugya. Like it really, right, he really starts from the Gemara, he gives you a synopsis of all the Rishonim, and he gives you the Halacha L'maisa. So I think that those two Sfarim are really good. If a guy wants to have a Halacha Seder, like this is what I learned for an hour a day, or you know, half an hour a day, something like that, I think that that both of those Sfarim are fine. If a guy likes Mishnah Berurah, okay, fine. I'm not going to tell you not to learn Mishnah Berurah. But I think that those two options are the best.
It's fine to be somech on the Aruch HaShulchan, even with the
somech on the Aruch HaShulchan.
With the mainstream stock that like people say that.
No, I don't know. Don't even say that to me.
Oh
my God, what?
Yeah, what? What people always say is that we pass the Mishnah Berurah. I don't know what that means practically.
Rav Shechter is what? Not a big fan of Aruch HaShulchan. Wow. Apparently the Chazon Ish was also not. Listen, this is a. I heard from a Rav in America who was a pulpit Rav in New Jersey for many, many years, that he heard from Rav Henkin Zatzal, from Yosef Henkin. He said, and someone asked him about the Aruch HaShulchan versus the Mishnah Berurah, and he said that the Chofetz Chaim was the Tzadik Hador, and the Aruch HaShulchan was the Posek Hador. That's what he said. Who? Rav Moshe also apparently, right, yeah. Right. Yes, Nachon. So the Aruch HaShulchan was, and this I heard from Rav Asher, that the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yosef Engel, and I believe the Beis Yitzchak, Shuvas Beis Yitzchak, were all sitting in a hotel together one day. So what are they talking about? After they were done with their fantasy football meeting, they asked each other what's like the purpose of a Rav, like the Rav of a city, like what's his main function, right? So the Aruch HaShulchan said that his job is to give a Piskei Halacha. That's his job, right? He has to be available to give Piskei Halacha. And Rav Yosef Engel said, no, he needs to be like a lamdan so that like people can come to him and talk and learning. Like there needs to be a guy that, you know, in the community that people can come to and talk to and learning. And I think the Beis Yitzchak said he needs to be able to, you know, like adjudicate cases, which basically that's, you know, appropriate to every single one of those personalities, obviously. You know, people tend to embody their opinions in that regard. But yes, the Aruch HaShulchan was a functioning, you know, a functioning posek in the Vardak, right? That's where he was. Yeah, he was a posek in the Vardak. Right? Rav Chaim was in Brisk, you know, for many, many years. I don't think that people ever saw him outside of Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuva. Yeah, like that was it. So different approaches. But I think that a clear advantage of the Aruch HaShulchan First of all, today, if you really want to be makbid on the Mishnah Berura side, you can get today the versions of the Aruch HaShulchan with the Piskei Mishnah Berura, if you really want to be from. But the a clear advantage of the Aruch HaShulchan, I don't think anyone can argue with this, is that he's giving you a perspective on halacha from the perspective of the lamdan, essentially, right? He's starting off with the Gemara, going through the Rishonim, based the halacha on that. Ironically, the Aruch HaShulchan on Koshen Mishpat is less like that than all the other halakim. It's interesting how that happened. I don't know why that is. But like an Aruch Chaim, Yerideya, it's really solid. Like, starts off with the Gemara, all through the Rishonim, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Achronim, like very, very misudar. So, yeah.
Like one more question on like the personal Rina Torah side. How do you split your time to continue learning now, even while working? And how can you like, you know, how can you get to for us now, like some people leaving yeshiva, to do that like long term, to split the learning with working?
Right. So I'll tell you, I'll be very, very honest. This is still for me a work in progress. Okay. And I've been doing this for a long time, and it's still a work in progress. When I leave yeshiva, I left yeshiva in Betzem 2012. I was no longer full-time in yeshiva, so like 10 years already. So it's still a work in progress. I'll say, first of all, I think that there's clearly stages in a person's life. And when a person is starting a professional track, he has to devote a lot more time and energy into starting that track. And there's nothing wrong with that. Right? I remember talking to a guy in yeshiva about 5 years ago. He was leaving. He was going to do an advanced degree in Michigan, and he had like a whole, you know, clear pass it out for himself. And we were speaking out, you know, the Gemara in Megillah, this is also a good var from Rav Asher. Chas v'shalom, not a var. The Gemara in Megillah says that you're Mevatel Talmud Torah from Mikra Megillah. So all the Achronim ask, what's the Bitul Torah? Like, listening to the Megillah is also Talmud Torah. So, what's the Bitul Torah to begin with? So there's all type of answers, you know, the time it takes you to walk to shul, that's Bitul Torah, and like all these, you know, less than on point answers, right? But Rav Asher says it's pasha, it's never pasha, right? Even if a person's sitting in shul, he's sitting in the, you know, in the place where they're gonna read the Megillah, and you know he's learning Baba Kama, and the second that the guy starts off with Vayihi Me'achashverosh, he closes the Gemara, listens to the rest of the Megillah, and then opens up the Gemara immediately afterwards. Even if he did that, it's also Bitul Torah. Why is it Bitul Torah? Because there's not just Bitul Torah bekamus with quantity. There's Bitul Torah be'echos. Bitul Torah be'echos. There's a qualitative Bitul Torah. And this, Rabosai, this is not Rav Asher. I don't want to equate this with what Rav Asher said. This is my thing, but I'm still pretty confident that it's true. This is the sod of what Reish Lakish says in the Gemara in Menachos, Lif'amim bitulo shel Torah zui kiyuma. That the nullification of Torah is its fulfillment. Why is that? Because there's some things that we have to do in order to be able to ramp up the quality of Talmud Torah that doesn't involve reading from a Gemara. That's just a fact. And you ignore that fact at your peril. Okay? Someone wants to be super firm and say, no, Bitul Torah, okay? Sorry, right? This is the long haul operation. This is literally a lifetime endeavor. So someone thinks that there aren't extraneous activities that they need to do in order to improve the quality of their Talmud Torah, then I'm sorry. It's just right. They're just unhinged from reality, right? Bitul Torah Zui Kiyuma is primarily, I believe, in this yisod, right? Because there is Bitul Torah Be'echos. This goes back also to the point that I said before about focusing on certain texts as opposed to other texts. That's for sure Bitul Torah Be'echos. For sure. That's not a question. Person learns 15 minutes of Rambam as opposed to an hour of something else, right? You'll fill in the blank, okay? It's for sure Bitul Torah. Like, not even a question is Bitul Torah, okay? So it's Bitul Torah be'echos. So, just to bring that back to the question of, like, the professional stuff versus the not, okay? Right? Like, when Chazal say, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, Vim Ein Kemach Ein Torah, and all of that stuff that I'm sure you've been inculcated with and indoctrinated with since you were little, okay? What they're saying is not just make sure that you have the material side of your life taken care of so you won't die of starvation and then you can go learn, right? No, they're saying something much more essential and deeper, right? And I think we learned this with a few guys in the Maharal Chabura on Pirkei Avos that Derech Eretz is a general phrase that Chazal use to a person being able to be oriented with the external world, with the material world. And not just like the kemach, the actual flour that you, you know, mix with water and then put in your mouth and digest. But it's all of the systems and structures that make up reality as such, right? In Ein Derech, Ein Torah, what we're saying is that Derech Eretz and Torah map onto each other. That's what we're saying. Derech Eretz and Torah map onto each other. And if a person has a chisaron in one, he has a chisaron in the other. That's just how it works. That's just the nature of things, right? Which is why la halacha lamaisa, right? The Gemara in Baba Basra, and there's a whole deal on this in the Achronim in the beginning of Choshen Mishpat, in Siman Aleph, that's in Choshen Mishpat, right? How old does a dayan have to be in order to be a dayan, right? Yushalmi in Sanhedrin says you don't need to be 13 years old, right? He's an ish already. He's a god, also zel. He could be dayan, right? But the Gemara in Shabbos says no, he has to be 18 because he's not mature enough. And the Gemara in Baba Basra says even more. He's unfamiliar with the nature of commerce. Can't be a dayan. How's he supposed to be able to orient himself if he doesn't know these things, right? So again, being familiar with the things, we're talking here on like a very superficial level, but being able to be oriented with the world and having first-hand interaction with the metzios, that's just part of Talmud Torah, right? Gemara says that Rav, he says, I spent 13 years by a roe bakar in order to know like what the mumim are, right? That is a form of smicha in and of itself, right? We have yore yore, yodin yodin, right? Matir matir. What's matir matir? Matir b'choros, right? Matir b'choros with mumim, right? To be able to know what the mumim are. So I didn't know what the mumim are. So he spent 13 years, right? Spent 13 years with the. Right? I'm sure he was doing other things during the 13 years also. It wasn't a full time job. He's saying he apprenticed with this person in order to be able to understand the metzius, right? So these are two sides of the same coin. And I understand that there are people that take this yesod too far and they say, yeah, my life experience is also Talmud Torah. No, that's not true. Your life experience is life experience, and your Talmud Torah is Talmud Torah. So this can be corrupted very, very easily, obviously. But we're all here, I'm sure, we're all here like very mature, and we understand that this needs to be balanced, but it's still important to recognize this reality. So where are we going with this? With the profession? Right. So that's why it's important to be able to recognize that there will be a tkufa in your life, almost certainly there will be a tkufa in your life, where you're more focused on building that side. And Torah will have to be less of a focus, just time-wise and bandwidth-wise. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two is what we were talking about on Shavuos, and for people who didn't hear, that this is the yesod of what Shammai HaZaken says, "Asei Torascha Kva'u Melachtecha Arai." Now, as I was saying to someone afterwards, in the Avos Rebbe Nasan, which is an alternative version of Avos, it doesn't say "Asei Melachtecha Arai." It doesn't say that. That's not the version. It just says "Asei Torascha Keva." Zeh, period. Why is that? Because the whole point of Asi Torascha Keva, it's not trying to point out a relational thing or like a relative thing. Like make Torah more important than everything else that's less important. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is that a person has to have a certain attitude towards Talmud Torah. And what's that attitude? The attitude is this is Keva. And Keva is not only a quantitative thing, it's also a qualitative thing. Meaning, this is the most important thing for me. This is the most important thing in my life. Now, everyone spends more time doing other stuff than the most important thing in their life, right? People see their coworkers at work more than they see some of their family members, for sure, right? Does that mean that their coworkers are more important? No, it just means that they have to, you know, allocate a certain number of hours to being with those people, and that's just the reality. But what's more important, the keva in their life, the keva relationship, is with their family, right? So a person has to decide, what's keva for me? What's keva, right? And the key to being able to have perpetual success in this is being able to make the decision in your consciousness, right, at the internal level, that Torah is keva. And as Chazal say, right, Chachamim Harishonim Asu Malachtan Arai V'Tarasam Keva, Vishneim Niskaimu B'Yadam. And I can tell you from personal experience that the times in my life where I have been lax in this regard, where I've not been able to keep my mind with Torah in Keva, everything starts to fall apart. Not fall apart, that's a little extreme. I start losing a hold on everything, not just on Torah, but on everything. Because ultimately, if a person is drawing his inspiration and his spirit from a domain beyond this temporal concrete reality, which I hope we all are, then in the end of the day, this is what you need in order to be able to function in anything. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, learning daf and ksubos, or if it's, you know, attending to your clients, which I'm sure you all will do successfully. So this is where it has to be, and to know that maintaining that balance is chas v'shalom to relate to that as a liability, because it's not a liability. It's not. Maintaining that balance ultimately allows us to be successful and streamline everything in both domains, and that's the knowledge that we have to maintain. Okay, so again, the 2 points. There will be periods of time where we have to allocate more focus to other things, and that's perfectly fine, okay? And for the long term, to be able to inculcate the consciousness that Torah is keva, perush, that Torah is the primary thing, that's the most important thing for me, and through that, being able to have the long-term stability in both domains. And again, I can tell you, I'm just warning you now, that this is true. I swear to you, it's true. It's not just me. I've spoken to many people who make this their life's goal, to be able to balance these two areas. And as long as that balance is maintained, there's shalom. When that balance gets off kilter, it's not good. It's not good. Okay? And Bezrat Hashem, we could just take that mussar on its face and not have to learn from experience. That's my hope for everyone here. Yeah. Oh.
How much are our shkafa play into politics? Like, should we be focused on politics and what's happening, or should we decide that, like, I have to be more right because I think it's like a moral thing to do, or is it should just be a big trail like, between that world and this one?
That's a really, really good question. it's not an easy question to answer. I would say that for sure, to make that fractured. Excuse me. That's not the word I wanted to use. That dualistic approach that there's like politics and then there's spirituality, it is not the Torah's view. It's not the Torah's view at all. In fact, all of Nevi'im and Ksuvim, we were just talking about the narratives in Nevi'im and Ksuvim, all the narratives in Nevi'im and Ksuvim are about what the, you know, what the kings did and what they didn't do, what they should have done, what they could have done, etc., etc. So clearly, the events at a national level have, right, there's certainly what the Torah has to say about those things, okay? I would say that there's a trap that people fall in, that because they recognize that that's true, that there is a connection between quote unquote the political domain and quote unquote the spiritual domain, because they know that that's true, so they say, oh, now every little thing that happens in politics, every little thing that this guy said in the Knesset or that guy said in the House, right, that has some type of deep spiritual meaning. Maybe it does. I don't know, but for sure it doesn't have enough significance that we should spend time thinking about it. Right? Not every little thing has to be filtered through such a lens. Right? And part of developing and being mature is to understand, like, what are the important things, what are the non-important things. Right? When the government of Israel decides that they're going to give away, right, the heartland of Eretz Yisrael, right, you can't say, oh, well, that's politics, that has nothing to do with Torah. No, like, that has something to do with Torah. Right? When the coalition is arguing with the government about how much to raise the budget for this thing as opposed to that thing, I don't know if it's like so central to your, you know, to your position on Hashkafa, right? So understanding where that line is obviously on a case-by-case basis. But for sure, to keep in mind that not every little thing that goes on in politics has to be interpreted in some type of, you know, yes, this is the beginning of the apocalypse as was told over by, yeah. Yeah, does that someone answer the question?
Yeah, but also just like on the point that things are going to be in this Shiva, like really, really push like a political model as something like we have to figure out, like whether or not like I should vote for this side or this side, like on feed there. So is that like a focus?
So again, I think that so first of all, it's a good question, and thank you for clarifying what you meant. But I still think that the yisod that I just said plays into that. I don't think that someone who doesn't vote for the most frum party is an apikoros because they're saying that they care about other things other than how long the beard is of the number one on the list, right? There are some people that don't think that. There's some people that say, no, I'm a Torah observant Jew, and Torah is the main priority in my life, so like I'm going to vote for the party that is the most religious. I would say that there are some considerations that are of their very nature. They're in the secular domain, but they have implications from a Torah perspective. You know, if someone were to say, "Yeah, I'm going to give all the money to the yeshivas," okay, is that what the Torah wants you to do? The Torah wants you to ignore, you know, like the water system and the electrical grid and all these other needs. Like, is that clearly what they want to do? Yeah, but they're the most religious party. Okay, but is that clearly the most religious thing to do? I don't think so. Right? So someone's going to say, like, I don't think that this is actually the approach, Al Pi Torah, that someone is meant to take. And certainly we should listen to our Rabbanim and hear what they have to say and understand the long-term consequences or implications of what the politicians are putting forward. But not everything that is on the surface advertising itself as the most religious is actually the most religious. Like everything. Like, just like everything is that way, it's the same thing in politics. Yeah. Huh?
Yeah.
Whatever, I think we're just going with it.
A couple guys have the Daven Maariv Shabbat, so whoever wants...
Did you stop? Did you make a minion afterwards?
How many guys?
Huh?
Is there enough guys here to make a minion?
You know, how many people have Daven Maariv? Have been Daven Maariv?
I'm saying, so a couple of us will go Daven.
So we'll record.
Yeah.
You guys need to go. We'll record. So my personal view on this is that the whole discussion of Ikvas of the Mashiach or not Ikvas of the Mashiach is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it's Ikvas of the Mashiach or not in terms of what it is that we do. First of all, there's a fascinating sefer, just I say this parenthetically, it's now a set of svarim, I think they're up to volume 3 already now, called Aschaltahi, which is essentially, it's a historical skira, right? Like just a comprehensive look on the reaction of different Gedolei Yisrael to when the State of Israel was established in 1948. And you'd be shocked to see who reacted, who responded to this event in a positive way, okay? Suffice it to say that pretty much all the big names that we're all familiar with from the later half of the last century were all signing off on this, right, in one way or another, either privately or even publicly, putting out kol kores in the newspaper, in the Palestine Post, as it was known back then, right? And using that lashon, right, aschalta de geulahi, okay? So, right, even using that language that has been today branded as very extreme, back when these things were actually happening and people were experiencing with their own eyes the open miracles that were being received by Klal Yisrael, so it was less extreme to use those terms. Now, when people are dancing to the tune of the Naturi Karta because they're willing to make a lot of noise, so now it's being branded as now you're an extremist, you're an outlier, you're whatever. But that, I say that in parentheses. But the point, but just to get to the heart of your question, I think that the whole thing is completely irrelevant. Because the way that we relate to Eretz Yisrael and Malchus Yisrael, again, Malchus Yisrael, Perush, right, being Mekayim, the mitzvah of being in control of Eretz Yisrael and establishing a government here, which the Rambam is Marich, you know, people always like to point out that the Rambam doesn't count Yish of Eretz Yisrael as a mitzvah. This is one of those, like, incredibly stupid things. I had no idea how this became a thing. That people's, he doesn't count as this. Yeah, but what he does count is the mitzvah to establish a Malchus in Eretz Yisrael, right? And he Marich in Chelek Beis of Mor Nebuchim and in Chelek Gimel about what the purpose of this Medina is supposed to be, and that we lost prophecy. The reason that we lost prophecy is because of the spiritual corruption that befell the Jewish people, that they didn't have their own place that they can call their own and build a society that was focused on Jewish identity and Torah. He says this. It's a tremendous loss. Right? He bases this, if I'm not mistaken, on the Gemara in Chagiga. And it says, right, Sarea the Yoatzea Bagola Ein Torah. That's a pasuk in Eicha. Right? Its officers and its wise men have been exiled. There is no Torah. That's what it says in the pasuk in Eicha. Right? It says the Gemara, Kevin Shenig Olu Yisrael Me'aretzam. Once Jewish people have been exiled from their land, Ein Lecha Bitul Torah Godol Mizeh. Again, the Bitul Torah Be'eichos question. Right? It's not a question of more or less Torah being learned. There's a lot of, you know, Torah being, right, going on in Surin Bombadisa. A lot. Right? But it's a question of, right, it's a question of Eichos. And when the Jewish people are outside of Eretz Yisrael, we quoted last night in the Chabura, right? Right? Uzahav ha'aretz ahi tov. And the gold of the land was good. Right? She'ein Torah k'Eretz Yisrael, ve'ein Torah, right? Ve'ein Chochma k'Chochma k'Eretz Yisrael. The wisdom and the Torah of Eretz Yisrael are qualitatively on a different plane than that which is outside. And that's accomplished, it's only able to be that way when there's a cohesive body of, you know, right, of Klal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. That's the whole message of the Rambam over there in Chelek Gimel, Perek Lamed something. I forget which Perek exactly right now. I can find you the quote if you want. The point that I'm trying to say is that our approach to the land of Israel and to establishing a state in the land of Israel, these things are based on halacha, right? And halacha hasn't changed. Halacha doesn't change because of 1948 or 1967, all these things, I mean, they're important, obviously, and we should relate to them in a certain way. The halakha also mandates how we should relate to those events, right? Which is a different discussion. But the point is that whether or not the geula is coming in the near future, right? I would love for the geula to come in the near future. Right? I'm not saying it's a bad thing, chas v'shalom. I'm just saying that whether or not we are in some stage called ashalta de geula is not relevant. It's just not relevant. So all this handling and arguing about is this chalta de geula, not chalta de geula, maisa sata, not maisa, doesn't matter, right? It's like the Torah tells us how to relate to these things, right? This is the Torah's approach how to relate to these things. The ideal is that Klal Yisrael should be in Eretz Yisrael. The ideal is that Klal Yisrael should establish a malchus in Eretz Yisrael. That's the ideal. And does the malchus as it is right now look like the ideal malchus? Absolutely not. I don't know the most frum, right, guy in Merkaz Arab. Is he going to tell you that yes, this is the chatchila situation? I don't think anyone's saying that. Like, who would say that, right? But in the days of the Chashmonaim, right, we celebrate the victory of the Chashmonaim, and as the Rambam says in Hilchos Chanukah, right, we're celebrating the fact, Shechazra Malchus Yisrael, Yosim Masayim Shana, right, that's what we're celebrating, okay? That Malchus Yisrael included the reign of Alexander Yanai, the great-grandson of Shimon. Okay, he executed an open persecution of Chazal, like he was killing the Chachamim. That's the Malchus Yisrael that Keilu the Rambam is celebrating, right? So there's a period where people like were worshiping idols here. Things are arguably from many perspectives a lot better now than they were back then, right? Okay, so it's not lechatchila. I understand it's not lechatchila, and I'm doing whatever I can in order to make sure that things can progress in a certain direction. Yes, I would love for things to change, but at the end of the day, right? This is Malchus Yisrael. This is Malchus Yisrael. Chazal were metakein a bracha to make on Ore Yehuda b'Chorbanam. It's a bracha. In the Gemara in Tainus, it brings this bracha. Right? If you see the cities of Judea in their destruction, you should make a blessing. You should make a certain blessing of mourning. Okay? So says the Beis Yosef in Hilchos Tisha B'Av, he says, what's Ari Yisrael b'Chorbanon? Right? If you see a built-up city of Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael under foreign rule, that's Chorban. It's Chorban. You should make a bracha on that city where there's people living there. Right? It's not desolate. You should make a bracha on, right, Ari Yehuda b'Chorbanam. But if you have a desolate city, that no one's living there, but it is under Malchus Yisrael, you don't make the bracha. So he says, right? So are you going to say that this isn't Malchus Yisrael? That this, oh no, the whole thing's b'Chorban. I think someone wants to say that is really pushing it. So while we have to aspire to make things more oriented to the Torah and more authentic to Torah values and Bezrat Hashem, that will continue to progress, right? In no way should we diminish the importance of it, and whether it's Aschalta de Geula or not Aschalta de Geula is a mute point. Yeah.
How do you explain the 150-year gap according to Chazal? It doesn't match up with the historians by the beginning of
That's a really good question, and I'll just say off the bat that I'm not an expert in this, but I have listened to many experts talking about this. I heard a very, very convincing shiur. This is in the context of a shiur on Sefer HaMakabim, that basically he argued, and I can forward the source to this on the group. He was arguing that the history of Chazal is a lot more accurate, just from a purely scientific, historical perspective. And the reason that he said that was for two reasons. First of all, we're discovering all the time that there were in fact distortions in different dating things that were going on in the Persian Empire or the Greeks, etc. And the other reason is because of all of the kilkulim involving the Gregorian calendar, right? Like the Gregorian calendar, everyone knows was very, very perverted in its order and its years, etc. But again, I don't know. I'm not an expert on that. I can't make an argument for that either way. Another perspective that I heard from a historian, a rabbi historian in Baltimore, Rav David Katz. He teaches Jewish history at Johns Hopkins. So he tainad that, and again, I can't give you the argument for this, but he was tainaing that Chazal intentionally distorted the history because they didn't want to reveal the order that was being given over in Sefer Daniel. And like talking about the Ketz Mashiach. Yeah, and he has Makaros to back this up, like to support this. That Chazal were right explicitly, but they weren't even interested in giving you like a linear history. They were interested in just highlighting the main points and like giving you over like what like these were the important events and like these were the important events in Jewish history, as opposed to giving you like a coherent timeline. That just wasn't their purpose. So those are the two approaches that I've heard. But again, I'm not an expert on this, so I can't argue either way. Yeah.
How much did historic, like history and historic context play into how we look at not just the Torah, but also the Shonim and the Achronim and different side because of different like circumstances and things like that?
You got to be a little bit more specific on that because there's a lot of directions you could take that in. Like you're referring to something specific about
just general,
like their knowledge of science or their. Or like how Psak would
how Psak would differ because their Psak then was under a circumstance that might not be shocked to us. So that's part of they
oh should. Yeah, right. So that's very important. That's very, very important to understand how very often the superficial at the superficial layer, the conversations that are going on in the Gemara and in the Rishonim appear similar to what we're dealing with when really they're not at all. A very, very good example of this, and maybe this is controversial, I don't know, but I'm still going to say it. A very good example is the whole opening sugya of Perek Kira in Shabbos, right? The third Perek of Shabbos. Talks about the gezerah of Chachamim, of putting food, right, on some type of heating device, either before Shabbos or after Shabbos. The Gemara makes various right distinctions right between Shia, right, which is before Shabbos, right, or Hanacha, which is after Shabbos, and Chazal made gezeros on which types of things could be used for this purpose. And again, there are distinctions in the heating elements. There's a difference between an oven, right, where you put something inside this, you know, structure, or a kira, where you put the thing on top. And there are different types of kiras, right? There's a kira that only has one spot to put things on, which the heat is hotter. There are kiras that have more than one spot. There's two spots, so like the heat on each one is less. You make all types of distinctions with these things and how you correct them in order to be able to put the food on, right? So what's basically the thing that you have to do in order to make the kira okay? What's the act that you have to do? Garifakatum, right? Garifakatum. What does Garifakatum do? Like, what is Garifakatum? Right. Well, right. So the gezera is mishum shema yechata begechalim, that you're gonna stoke the coals. Okay. So anyone who's ever made a barbecue knows that when you're cooking something on an open fire, so in order to keep the heat going, you have to stoke the coals constantly in order to keep the heat going. That's just how it works. So in order to avoid that, in order to avoid that possibility, so Chazal said, either don't use certain types of heating elements, or if you're going to use the heating elements, make sure that it's garuf fakotum. Because once you cover over the coals with like dust or something, or you, right, or you, you know, move them over to the side or something, right, you're not going to come to do that. Okay? So what this means is that if you're using a device to heat up something on Shabbos, that mechata b'gechalim is not a thing, then it's not under the rubric of that gezera. Okay? Now, again, this could be controversial. I don't want to be understood as like making a, like a general psak halach over here, but I think that this is a very important example. It kind of highlights the question you just asked. On the surface, Chazal are saying the word kira, right, oven, and we're using the word kira. We have ovens and they have ovens, right? So they're talking about their ovens. Whenever they're saying about their ovens, is relevant to our ovens. I think that's just an honest analysis shows that that's just completely not true, right? According to their own definition, they themselves, Chazal themselves, made distinctions between certain heating elements that operate in one way and elements that operate in a different way. Yeah. So I think this is something important to keep in mind with the right, and this goes also with the material, right? A very good example is the materials that we use in order to cook, right? As far as Isser Veheter goes, right? Chazal themselves are talking about different types of material that are more porous or less porous. They have more blia or less blia. Glass, stainless steel. This is worth looking up. The topic of stainless steel specifically. Okay, there are many, many right scientific like laboratory level tests that were done on stainless steel to see how much blia there actually is. And basically, long story short, it's akin to glass. It almost isn't balea at all. It's balea maybe one part in 7,000, which is infinitesimal, okay? And already the Rishonim are writing, the Rashba says this in a tshuva, which is brought in Hilchos Basar V'Cholov, that if a person drops, right, a minuscule amount, let's say, in a new kli, a minuscule amount of cholov into a pot, when the pot is used to cook enormous amounts of meat, and there's no reason, there's no realistic chashash that it's ever going to be less than shishim, then you can use the pot, right? Because there's just no reasonable assumption that it's ever going to produce enough tam to trafe up the food. So again, all these are just examples. I don't want anyone to take anything that I'm saying here as a psak halacha, but I'm just giving you examples in order to appreciate what it is that we're talking about. When we approach Chazal, we have to know what it is that they're talking about, what are the circumstances, and why it is that they said that. And again, understanding that is just part and parcel of the Talmud Torah itself, to understand like the yesod of the thing. So that's what I would say. Yeah? Yeah.
How do you balance, like going on that point, in terms of just, like, Zama Makhdemara and, like, a chronim, like, if stock, like, looking at this motion and say, like, oh, he was dealing with something that was a different time period, now it's a little different, like, in terms of, like, much more recent stock. I know it was, like, considered, like, for that specific time period, and then maybe now it's a little different.
So I think it's the same methodology, just to understand what the psak is based on. There's a whole controversy a number of years ago about electric shavers, whether or not they're akin to shaving with a razor. So, right, the rule of thumb for many, many years was that a machine is fine because it's not right, the blade isn't making contact with the skin, and it's not, etc., etc. And then someone noticed that the shaving companies, in their wisdom, invented a method, what's called in the industry, it's called lift and cut, which basically means that there's a dual action on the shaving mechanism. This isn't relevant to me, as you can see, right? But there's a dual action on the spinning blades, that the first time the blade goes around, it latches on to the hair and lifts it up. This is all happening, right, in like a fractions of a second, right? But it lifts it up into the film, okay? It's like it lifts it up higher so that the whole thing can be like, you know, struck down by the next run of the blade, okay? Right? Which is what gives these machines an extremely, extremely close shave. Basically, you can't tell the difference between using a blade and using a zet. People say, oh, well, it's just super efficient, and the film is really, really thin, but at the end of the day, it's not like a razor. But no, Lamaisa, it is. Right? So there's these new innovations that are going on all the time. Right? Again, it all comes down to a change in the metzius. Right? The halacha doesn't change. The halacha doesn't change. And this is an important yesod. The halacha does not change. But the yesodos do. and understand, right? Excuse me. The foundations which we're dealing with in the material world does change. And it's not just the concrete reality, it's also the dynamics of the thing. I think we're talking about, with you, Noam, maybe not you, someone else over here. Someone else is here. I actually heard this example from Rav Schechter Shlita. He said that there's a piska. I don't want to misquote this. There's a piska in Abi HaEzri, which is the Sefer of Rav Shach on the Rambam, talking about different types of schiros and kinyan batim and all this. And basically, what he says over there is that that which the Rishonim said that this type of a schiros batim puts the achrayos on the renter is no longer relevant today. Why not? Because the dynamics of renting have changed. When a person says, "I'm renting a house," the kinyan is different than what the kinyan was, right, in earlier generations. This is a different kinyan. So can you say that the physical reality has changed? No, there's no physical reality that's changed. Right? It's not like the shaver that was 50 years ago and the electric shaver that's today. No, there's no physical reality change. It's just a dynamics change, right? So even that change a person has to be aware of, right? Which again goes back to the thing that we were talking about before, about like the idea of Derech Eretz and Torah, which again, all that means is that the external reality and the internal reality map onto each other. That's all. That's right. That's all that means. Right. It's a lot, but that's what it means. Yeah.
I guess also kind of connected to the last two questions. How do poskim approach different ideas in Chazal that, like, they say that was applicable then, like the Matthias has changed, or we no longer follow a certain. Certain psak that the Chazal gave, or a certain takana. Like, for example, Rav Shechter says that we're able to eat fish and meat on the same plate because it's just no longer there's no concern. So he eats on the same plate, same fork, same knife, same bite,
right.
Same time.
You should know, by the way, that even in the Gemara, it says that the person that the chashash is only when you cook them together. Yeah, so we've done like a chumrah and a chumrah and a chumrah to like not eat them on the same plate, not eat them with the same fork, and all these things. But there's a distinction here between things that Chazal spoke about in the area of refuah, of like medicinal benefit, and things that Chazal are talking about in a purely halachic context, right? So like the meat and fish thing, you know. For all that we can tell, this was a statement that was made from the perspective of its medicinal qualities, right? So it's not; it shouldn't be surprising that the Rambam doesn't bring that in the Mishnah Torah, right? Doesn't bring that halacha. One could say even from the Gemara itself, it says that this thing is kasha l'davar acher. Does it say that it's forbidden? I don't know if one can say that it's like even Chazal intended it for it to be definitively forbidden. But again, if we're just focusing on things that Chazal were talking about in the material world, then, you know, if we're observing that we can't replicate that reality, like we were talking about the other night about the Tshuvas HaGeonim that talks about the refuos of Chazal, right? That already in the times of the Geonim, which is just a few generations after the Siyum HaShas, that they said it was forbidden to try to implement any of the refuos of Chazal. It's forbidden. Yeah, because you can kill someone, right? So, right, that's basically what it comes down to. That we have to be able to have some grasp of what Chazal were talking about when things were relating to the material world. A really good example of this, by the way, is the controversial remark about killing kinim on Shabbos, right? Killing certain types of insects on Shabbos, because Chazal asserted that this type of insect doesn't produce sexually, right? There's no male and right. If there's no male and female, right, union in order to produce an animal, there's no prohibition of killing it on Shabbos. So this type of insect produces asexually, right? It, right, as Chazal say, it's generated from the air. That's what Chazal understood, right? That these insects are generated from the air. Okay, so therefore, there's no prohibition of killing them. Tov. Now, we observe these types of insects. Again, the same words that Chazal are using, we observe these insects. And yeah, they are produced in the same way that all other animals are produced. So is someone going to say, oh, well, Chazal said, so I'm going to go ahead and kill them. You're going to risk the Isser Kares in order to go kill these insects on Shabbos? I'm not going to take that risk. And it's interesting because Rav Zamir Cohen, who's very, as some of you might know that name, he's very into all this stuff about, like, you know, Chazal's comments on science and all that. I'm not really a bucky in his work, but one thing that I did come across was very interesting, that there is a type there is a species of kinin that we know that they produce asexually, right? That the bug is generated off of the body of one bug without any union of male and female. They said maybe, right, this could very well be the species of kinin that Chazal were talking about. Okay, fine, very interesting. But again, it's just at that point, it's just a question of mitzvahs. It's just a question of reality. Do they produce in this way? Do they not produce in that way? Yeah.
So what about stainless steel?
Steel, as you brought up before. So I don't want anyone to walk away with a psak halacha on these things. But that was just an example to give a concrete understanding.
So basically, yeah. You're saying, I mean, what about non-scientific things? Like something was specifically, I get to account for. I hear sometimes.
The 2-day psak.
No, not 2-day psak, but. But things that specific takanos that they had, which sometimes you hear poskim that they're no longer applicable. Sometimes you think that they shouldn't be, but they still are.
So again, we have to approach each thing on its own merits. The Gemara in Beitza says that we learn from the stories in the Midbar that once something has been prohibited by one Sanhedrin, it requires another Sanhedrin to be moderate, right? Even if the original reason for the prohibition is no longer there, right? We learn that from Mamad Har Sinai, yeah? When people were commanded to prepare in a certain way and to refrain from certain activities, and they were only able to go back to those activities once there was a separate matir. So we learn from there that once Chazal make a certain gezerah, so that gezerah is applicable even if the original circumstances aren't there. With that said, if Chazal themselves encode within that gezerah the parameters in which it's applicable, okay, then Hagufa, it applies in the parameters that they said, right? And I think that the Kira example is a really good example. There's a piska from Rav Chaim Noah, like the Grach Noah that everyone knows from the Shiurim, right? From the Shiurim business and the Kuntrasa Shiurim that he wrote in response to the Chazonish. So there's a really interesting piska that he wrote about refuah on Shabbos, okay? Basically he says that. The Rishonim write, this is explicit in the Rambam in Perek Chafei of Hilchos Shabbos, and it's already mashur from the Gemara like this, that a refuah that doesn't require shchikas samimonim is allowed on Shabbos, right? The Gezerah of Chazal on medicine on Shabbos doesn't apply to things that don't require shchikas samimonim. So things today like massage or chiropractic or something like that, things that are refuah, but they don't involve medicine. Okay, so they're outside of the boundaries of that. That's what the Rambam says. So says Rav Chaim Noah, okay, so we can, it's not such a far extrapolation. He doesn't say this definitively, to be fair. He doesn't say la halacha l'maisa, but he says it pretty strongly. He says that you could follow from there that basically we have to examine every single type of medicine that we have. Is this a medicine that people generally are meshachek samimanim in order to produce this medicine or not? That's the question. If yes, it's usur. If not, it's mutter. Okay, so find me a medicine today that people typically take that shchikas samimonim is involved in taking that medicine. It's just right, it almost doesn't happen.
Before you, not when you eat it, not when you take, when you follow.
Right, so you're making the distinction between saying types of medicine that don't involve shchikas samimonim at all,
yeah,
as opposed to some that does involve it, but at a previous stage.
Right.
Right, so he's tying, no, it has to be closer than that. It has to be when individuals that are ill are taking this medicine, the process that they go through in order to apply or deploy the medicine for themselves involves shrikas samimonim, right? That's why Chazal are always using the example of the kiloi ha'ayin, of that, this thing that they used to put on their eyes in order to, you know, cure like cure some type of like inflammation or something. It's not exactly clear like what this condition was, but it would involve taking you know, these herbs and like mushing them up into some type of like gel or something and like applying it to the eye. So there are several malachos involved in doing that, right? So yeah, so that's why there was a gezeira against it.
Rambam talked about Hetter Torah, you know, like worry for everyone, and like matter of fact, whatever intellectual level. When it comes to Torah's Mister, is there like a level that you have to have in terms of, first of all, what they gain in the BS by Shas and everything, and then also intellectual level that maybe not everyone's up to when it comes to Torah's Mister as well.
Okay, so there's a few parts to that question. So first of all, the lashon that the Rambam uses a few times in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Kisra Shel Torah, it talks about why you have to learn Torah at night, because you're not zochet Kisra Shel Torah only if you learn at night. Talks about Kisra Shel Torah versus the other ksarim. And then there's the part of Nistar. So the Rambam over there in Hilchos Talmud Torah, he says that the area called the two areas called Maisa Bereishis and Maisa Merkava are included in Talmud. Right, so it's like there's Mikra, Halacha, and Talmud, or Mishnah and Talmud. So the Maisa Merkava and the Maisa Bereishis, the more esoteric areas of Torah, are included in Talmud. That's what he says. Okay, Mashma, that when the Rambam says that you should spend at least a third of your time developing in Torah, you should put it on Talmud, so it includes those areas. And not only that, but he says at the end, and this is kind of a chiddush, he says that once a person has mastered the Mishnah and mastered the Tanakh, so he doesn't need to spend a third of his day on those things anymore. He should spend some time to review in order so that he'll keep his memory of the Tanakh and the Mishnah, but he should spend most of his time on Talmud. Right? That ostensibly includes these areas as well. There's many backhanded comments of the Rambam throughout his Ksavim that indicate, and I'm not saying that I'm like a bucky in all the Kisvei Rambam, but from like just from what I know, many comments that he makes, it indicates that the areas of Machshava were essential to him. Right? The last comment that he makes in his Perush Al HaMishnah in Maseches Brachos, he says, "Ein davar yakar li el mililmo davar echad min ha'emunah." There's nothing more precious to me than to teach one facet, like one teaching of faith, right? That's the most important thing to me. So in terms of how to divide that between like the Nigla and the Nistar, I don't know if there's any there's certainly nothing in Chazal that says how much a person should divide his time between this and that. There are certainly Chachmei Yisrael that focused more on Inyane Machshava as opposed to Inyane Halacha, right? In the Yerushalmi and Yevamos, it makes a backhanded statement. It says, you know, there's a machlokas in Chazal about such and such a thing, right? And the Rabbanei Da'agadata, they say this, right? The Rabbanei Da'agadata. I mean, there's this group of Chachamim that they spend most of their time focusing on these areas. Right? I remember the Ramchal in Derech Eitz Chaim, which is a hakdama to the Sefer of Chaim Vital. So he says explicitly, listen, a person should like spend the first the first part of their career going through the Rambam and the Rif and the Gemara and just like get that out of the way. Just get the Gemara and the Rambam and the thing. Just get that out of your way, and then you could spend some time doing Chazara so that you won't forget it, and then spend the rest of your time on Nistar. That's what he says. So did all Chachmei Yisrael agree with this approach? Certainly not, right? So I think that a lot of this depends on a person's personal nitiyah, how much they're drawn to a certain area of Torah, right? But again, the esoteric areas of Torah are included under the rubric of Talmud that Chazal talk about. How this is part of the endeavor of getting deep into knowledge of Torah. I do think, though, I'll just add, this is probably a topic in and of itself, but I do believe that in the same way that we said how Derech Eretz and Torah map onto each other, Nigla and Nistar also map onto each other. That a person is ultimately going to be lacking in his knowledge of Nistar if he does not have strong foundations in Nigla, right? as Rav Asher pointed out once during one of his shiurim, right? Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa is known as the miracle worker, but he's Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. And Rabbi, as the Yerushalmi in Chagiga says, right, Rabbi means that you can give a psak on Kol Torah Kula, and not just the Shulchan Aruch, like Hilchos Karbanos and Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara and everything. So Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa was quite the lambda, right? If he was Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, yeah. So having that knowledge is essential to having a strong foundation in, right, in Nistar. The Arizal spent most of his, right, the early part of his life learning with the, who was the Rebbe of the Arizal in Nigla?
Radvaz.
Radvaz? I think he learned, well, I think that was a little bit later. What? Yeah, in Egypt. It was a little bit later, though. Before that, he was learning with Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi, the Baal Shita Mekubetzes. And in fact, there's some evidence to suggest that the Arizal actually helped write some of that, of the Shita Mekubetzes. Yeah. So he's learning with the Shita Mekubetzes. And then, you know, he finished Nigla, you know, I don't know how long it took him to, you know, get through that stage. And then he, you know, he shifted, right? The Arizal, he lived in a hut by the Nile River for like 7 years. He would come home on Erev Shabbos. Come home on Erev Shabbos, spend the weekend with his family, and go back to the hut. Spent 7 years doing that. And then one day he came home and he said, guys, we're going to Eretz Yisrael, yalla. And then that's what he did. So this was this, yeah. So this that was the life of the Arizal. But yeah, the point that I'm making is just that is just right in this right, the internal and the external always map onto each other. They always do, always, right? So and this is right. This is this works in a holonic structure, and by that I mean right. It's just concentric circles of reality. So just like Torah on the one hand and Derech Eretz on the other hand map onto each other. So when we go further inside to the circle, so to speak, when we get into Torah itself. Right, Nigla and Nistar also map onto each other. Okay, everything maps onto each other. The internal and the external are always mapping onto each other. And if a person is holding, right, has a lack in one area, it's going to ultimately come at the expense of the other area. In general, yeah, yeah.
To what extent, with regards to Achronim, when they give svaras for their halachic psak, can you say I understand this psak more than that psak, or even like if there's a Sephardi psak that he gives his reasoning behind it and it makes much more sense than the Ashkenazi psak, can you hold like that?
Okay, so first of all, absolutely, right? It's like that. Right, this is the enterprise of Talmud Torah to identify the svaras that make more sense, so to speak, as opposed to the ones that don't make more sense. Yes, I mean this is primarily the job of a posek, right? At that point, like to make a choice, you know, which svara is more ikar ledina, right? Or as Rav Asher likes to say, misyashev al alev, right? So that's for sure the avoda of the Talmud Chacham and for the posek for sure to make that distinction, you know. The second part that you said, right, you mentioned the thing about like the distinction between Ashkenazi and Sephardi. That distinction is a made-up distinction that doesn't really exist. Unfortunately, there are people that are still stuck with that, with the belief that that's a thing. You know, if someone is going to say that, oh, well, my great-grandfather was from Lita, and therefore I have the right to be Mako automatically, I don't know why someone feels so brazen to say that. If there's another svara that happens to be from one of the Chachmei Svarad that makes more sense, that's more machmir, I have the right to be Makel just because I don't know how anyone can say that with in good faith. The reality that we live in today is qualitatively different than the reality of Klal Yisrael throughout the vast majority of the Golos, in that most Jews lived in communities that were more or less continuous, right? Meaning, like, people lived in the same areas for many, many generations. So, like, the minhag hamokum, okay, was applicable. Or the mora da'asra was applicable, right? That concept, right? These concepts were very, very strongly applicable. But now you have, you walk down the street over here, right? On one side of the street, you have a Sanzer Chassid. On the other side of the street, you have a Moroccan Zeh, right? So, like, you're gonna tell me that, right? No, I'm just saying you're going to tell me there's a minag hamukam in such a place? I think it's silly to suggest that, right, just because just because we're the biological descendants. And I'm not saying that culture isn't important. That's not what I'm saying. For sure, there is a cultural reality of Ashkenazim versus other Eduyot, right? Eduyot HaMizrach, or Eduyot Sfarad, or Eduyot Teiman, etc., etc. For sure, that's a thing, and that's important, and it enriches our experience of Torah and Shmiras HaMitzvot, no question. But in terms of making a halachic decision about which Rishon we should follow, or, you know, which Sfarad makes more sense, it's just a made up thing. I'm sorry, it's just completely made up. And you know, if someone's going to say that I'm going to be makel because of this, right? Or the other way, that I have to be machmir because of that. It's just not a. That's what I would tell.
More like Rav Schechter versus Rav Usher Weiss than Rishonim. It's like modern.
Oh, that's a different question. When you talk about a contemporary postgame, a person has to make a decision. Who is it, right? Right. The Mishnah Novos says, "Asei l'charav," right? So what does that mean? It means this is my Rav as opposed to that Rav, right? The person needs to. Okay, so that first of all, that could be talked. If a person is already at the maturity of Talmud Torah where he can recognize the difference of Svara, I think that if a person is very, very sure of himself, then he can already make that decision for himself. I don't think that's such a brazen thing to do. Ideally, right? Then you can have the conversation with both or at least one of those poskim. You could say, Rebbe, you know, I heard this other svara that says such and such for this and this reason, right? What would the Rav have to say about that, right? The Rosh Kollel by us at Nachlaot, he told me a story where he went to Rav Lichtenstein many, many years ago. Rav Lichtenstein's Zatzal asked him a question about a certain thing. And Rav Lichtenstein, I told him one thing, and he said, "Yeah, I heard a psak from Rav Goldberg that said the opposite for this and this reason." And he said, "Okay, yeah, I think that's good. You should go with that, right?" So to be able to talk it out is that's another stage of maturity, and us, who merit to sit in the Beis HaMedrash and have a familiarity with these things, right? It's not just going over to the Rav and asking, you know, Asur Mutter, and say, right? But it's also like to be able to understand a little bit. The Taz already brings in Hilchos Tarovas, he says that any posek, even if he's speaking to a complete Am Haaretz, should try to explain a little bit of the reason for the psak. He shouldn't just say Asur and, you know, close the door. He should say, you know, it's Asur for this and this reason, right? And that's for a complete Am Haaretz, right? Kal v'chomer, right? Us and Yeshiva, again, who we merit to have, you know, to have a grasp of these things, we should feel open, and we should be encouraged to engage with the conversation. I think that's.
Based on that, is it particularly important to have one posik and then go by them for the most part, or is it okay to like?
I think it's important to have a consistent shita. Yes, and the reason is just because a person will end up if he's expanding the circle too much, he'll end up making for himself contradictions because the different psakim will be based on yesodos or ideas or approaches that are self contradictory. Not self-contradictory, but inter-contradictory. That's why I feel that a person should keep it tight. Of course, again, it goes without saying, that as a person's knowledge of Torah, his own personal expertise in Torah, develop that you could appreciate those differences and those nuances, then you can expand your circle more and more, right? But it has to go in tandem. And ideally, a person should have one person or two people that they go to when they have a specific shaila, and that should be the limit. Yeah.
What is the role of minhagim nowadays?
So again, this idea of minhagim has kind of become, unfortunately, this idea of minhagim has become like this general catchphrase for everything that isn't said explicitly, you know, in Chazal or in, basically, if it's not in Chazal and the person does it, it's like, this is my minhag. But, the idea of a minhag has a specific definition. And you know, there's a whole perek in Shas, in the fifth parak of Psachim, that it just talks about this, like, what's the definition of a minhag? So to give you the abridged version, the minhag is taloi in a place. The minhag hamakom. There's no such thing as minhag outside of a minhag hamakom. Yes, a person can take on a personal practice and it has a pseudo neder status. That's something different. I'm talking about minhag, when people talk about minhagim, strictly speaking, this right, the minhag is a function of the place. If you have a place that has a certain practice, then you have to abide by that practice. It's obligatory. You have to abide by it. Okay? And that's why it says that if a person leaves his makom and goes to another makom and he's visiting there for a while, nosin olav chumre hamakom sheyatza misham, the chumre makom sheyegia lesham. Right? Yes, both chumras. The chumras of the place that he lives in and the chumras of the place that he's visiting. Right? Which is why most, I believe, again, I don't want to speak for most post-game, I don't know what that means, but as I'm saying, typically speaking, a person right, lives in Eretz Yisrael, goes to Chutz La'aretz, can't do malacha. Can't do malacha while they're there, because that's the minug, right? It's the minug, right? It's the minug morvachas and all of Chutz La'aretz that people are keeping 2 days of Yom Tov, and it's also to do malacha while you're there, even though a person lives in Eretz Yisrael. Just as an example, right? Just to be marking on this Indian just a little bit, right? Just to understand, you know, what we've lost with the proper understanding of minhagim, because the idea of minhagim is a very, very powerful idea, right? The Gemara learns this from the pasuk, right, in Mishle, the beginning of Mishle, Al titosh toras imecha, right? Shema avi, right, lemusar avicha, there's musar avicha, and then there's toras imecha. Says the Gemara, toras imecha, right, that's a minhag. Those are minhagim, okay? How does the Gemara know that? How does the Gemara know that toras imecha is referring to minhagim, okay? So this is a very, very important yisod. The Nevi'im, in many, many places, refer, right, when they're rebuking Klal Yisrael, they refer to the mother of Klal Yisrael. The mother of Klal Yisrael. Like, for instance, in Yechezkel Perek Tesvav, Im Ye Imecha Kilviya, like, your mother is like a lioness, okay? Or in Perek Nun of Sefer Yirmiyo, right, Bosha Imechem, your mother is ashamed, okay? So who is the mother of the Jewish people? Who is the mother, right? And it's not referring to the Imo, so that's not what it's referring to, okay? So the Targum Uziel, okay, which is, right, we know that, right, the prime disciple of Hillel HaZaken, who wrote a Targum on all of Nevi'im, in all of the places where the Nevi'im refer to the Aim Yisrael, okay, they translated it, right, he translated it as Knesses Yisrael. Knesses Yisrael, meaning, Perush, there are all the individual Jews. And then there's the collective of the Jewish people. There is the Jewish people. That's an entity. There's the collective of the Jewish people. Okay? Toras Imecha means the Torah that emerges from the collectives of the Jewish people. Meaning when there's a tzibur of Yisrael and they have a certain practice, that's Toras Imecha. Right? And you don't even have to be so fancy and go to Targum Uziel. Gemar Mufresh is in Maseches Brachos. Right? It says anyone who doesn't who fails to make a bracha, right, he's gonev from Knesses Yisrael, he steals from Knesses Yisrael, okay, and the Gemara brings the proof. How do we know this? Because it says Al titosh toras imecha, okay. Knesses Yisrael is the aim; it's the mother. There's no Targum Uziel on Mishle, right? So it doesn't say anything over there by aim, but. That's the idea, right? That's a minug. Minug means the Torah that emerges from the collective. When you have a tzibur of Jews, they come together saying, this is what we're doing, and that's what we're going to do. And everyone that's part of that group has to abide by that thing, because that's the Torah. That's the Torah of the mother, right? The Torah of the mother, right? And it's a shame, right? What is meant to be a mechanism of cohesion for a tzibur, that we're all together and this is what we're doing, has now become a means for dividing. Like, oh, this is my minhag, this is your minhag. No, it doesn't work that way. The whole point is that we're all together, and this is what we're doing. Together as a group, right? But now, again, you have, right, in any given street on Yerushalayim, you have the one side of the street, right, this guy's grandfather was from here, and this guy's grandfather was from the other side of the world. Okay, it's not, right, it's in direct opposition to the original theme. That's my take on it. And I think, right, again, I think that this is just the Pasha understanding of the there's a fascinating letter that's brought in Tosefes Ma'aseh Rav, which is right. The Sefer Ma'aseh Rav is the Minhagim of the Gra, very important Sefer. Not Minhagim like we're talking about now. Like I'm saying, like the halachic practices of the Gra. Okay, which is a very important Sefer. And then there's Tosefes Ma'aserav, which was added by one of his Talmidim later on, just like little tidbits that he heard from his Rebbe. And he said that he had a letter that the Gra wrote before he left to Eretz Yisrael, right, the trip that was never successful, that he wrote to one of his Talmidim. He said, you know, one of the reasons why I'm so excited to go to Eretz Yisrael is that I will no longer have to abide by the Minhagim of Poland. Right? That's why I'm excited to get out of here. Right? So I no longer have to, right, that those Minhagim are no longer, that they're no longer obligatory. There's a distinction, by the way, and this is in Yoredeya and Simen Reish Nun Dalet, if not mistaken, that there's a difference between a minag hamakom and a cherem hamakom. Because there's a possibility that the Beis Din of a certain place can make a cherem, okay, can decree a cherem on all the people there that they have to abide by a certain thing. And there, if someone is there at that time, their descendants also have to abide by that, which is why the idea of a cherem is such a strong thing, which also has to do with, you know, the other charamim that I'm sure you've all heard about, right? The charamim of Rabbeinu Gershom and other such things. Those do apply to the descendants of the people.
Isn't it no longer apply or something like that?
It was only decreed for 1,000 years, and the time frame. There's a lot of diunim about that. I was just giving that as an example so you understand what a cherem is. A cherem means that the Beis Din of a certain place made a cherem. They made a decree, and all the descendants of those people forever have to abide by that. So that's a distinction. Yeah. Yeah.
Separate topic. Do you think that we should try, or the leaders of Klai Israel should try to establish the Sanhedrin nowadays? And how do you think they would do that in modern times?
I mean, fine. So there's a few points to this question. There's a machlokas already for 500 years as is well known, when the Chachmei Tzfat attempted to kick off the Sanhedrin thing, and there was opposition from the Chachmei Yerushalayim, that felt that this was not possible. There's just people that aren't familiar with the background. The Rambam writes in two places, one time in Hilchos Sanhedrin and one time in his Perush on Mishnayos, that it's theoretically impossible to reestablish the smicha with the agreement of all Chachmei Yisrael. He doesn't define what all Chachmei Yisrael are, but he says that in theory it's possible to reestablish the smicha. Now, the Chachmei Tzfat, okay, at that time, We are talking about the Gedolim Shebe Gedolim, right? The entire Jewish world recognized that the center of Torah was in that city at that time. Very, very short window of time, but nonetheless, right? A good period of time, where you had the Ma'arit, and you had the Beis Yosef, and you had the Alshech, and you had the Arizal, and you had Moshe Alkabet. You had the entire spectrum of the Masorah, the Chochmei Masorah, Rav Yaakov Beirav, right? And all of these. Right, Gedolim Shebe Gedolim. They were all there in one time, in one place, and this was the golden opportunity. I don't know if we ever had an opportunity before modern times to say that all Chachmei Yisrael can get together and do such a thing, and they did it. Right? There's also an idea. This is not a halachic idea per se, but excuse me, I take that back because it does have halachic repercussions. That if the klal is not prepared to receive such a thing, or to go with the flow, so to speak, then it becomes irrelevant, right? The Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim says, right, Chazal are constantly making references to Ein Gozrin Gezerah al Tzibur Elajim Kein Rov Tzibur Cholim Lamod Bo. You can't make a decree on the congregation unless most of them are able to handle it. So says the Rambam, how do you know if most of them are able to handle it? So he says, well, if people go along with it, then they're able to handle it. And if they don't go along with it, then it means they're not. That means, you have to understand the implications of this, that every gezerah, so to speak, of the Sanhedrin, okay, there was a interim period, so to speak, where they were seeing whether or not people were actually obeying what the Sanhedrin told them to do. Yeah? And if they saw that most people weren't going along with it, then that would be batal. And we're actually familiar with some of those gezerahs. In the Gemara on Shabbos, it talks about how the... What? The Takanas Ezra of Muksa. Yeah. Yes, is that what you're referring to?
It means more than one.
Well, several, right, there were a few in that time, in the first generation of the people that came back to Eretz Yisrael after the Chorban Bayis Rishon, that certain Gezeris that they never took root. right? An example is that they were gozer on basically all kalim. Like you could put them in the position that you want before Shabbos, like the chairs. You keep the chairs where you want them to be all Shabbos, and that's it. You can't move them. you could sit on them there, and like that's it. You can't move them until Motzei Shabbos. And that gezera never took right. It wasn't I think actually that's a bad example because I'm thinking, if I remember correctly, that it says that they actively nullified the gezera. It wasn't just that it was rejected.
But anyway,
be that as it may, it doesn't matter. The point is that this is what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that it needs to be accepted by the people. Right? There's no significance to the gezera of the Sanhedrin if the people don't accept it. So if Klal Yisrael is in a position where they're not going to recognize these things and it's not going to be given weight, then it's kind of all for naught. I mentioned Rav Bar Chaim recently when Rav Adin Steinzel Zatzal established his Sanhedrin. This is probably already like 15 years ago already. He took many, many Chashev Rabbanim, got them all together in Netivot, and established the Sanhedrin, right? And Rav Steinzel was, the Av Beis Din. This was a very, very prestigious collection of Talmid HaChachamim, and they wanted to jump right into it. They were doing Kiddush HaChodesh. I actually know the astronomer who lived in Efrat for a while, who went down and spoke to them about it. Fascinating guy. I think he actually lives in France. But that guy was a trip. Oh my God. He was like a sea captain and astronomer and he learned like Jewish philosophy for years in YU. Very interesting guy. Anyway, he went and explained to them about how to do the Kiddush HaChodesh business. It was very, very interesting. They wanted to go full throttle, like pedal to the metal. Sanhedrin, Kiddush HaChodesh. Boom. So Rav Bar Chaim, he was one of the Chachamim asked to be part of this, to be part of the Sanhedrin. And he told me that the reason that he declined to be there is because he felt that the approach was wrong. And I think that this was very wise of him. Why? Because he said, listen, if you're going to establish a Sanhedrin and say, okay, now we're ancient Judea now, and we're all going to, start wearing, kafiyas and, live like it was back in the Zeh, right? And do Kiddush HaChodesh and bring Karbonis and all this. Like, people are going to think that you're just a bunch of schleppers, or just a bunch of, crazy people. And, no one's going to pay attention to you. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. He says, if such a project was going to happen, what needs to be is that it starts slow. And by slow, he says that it has to start addressing halachic issues that are close to daily practice of people and that people want to know. And there's a lot of ambiguity surrounding them. A big issue for him that he thought would be a great thing to start off with is the whole topic of shiurim, of measurements, right? Shiurim la'alacha. It's a very, very, very nebulous topic for people. People have no idea, what an olive, but it's not really an olive, and olives used to be bigger, and now they're smaller, and, which type of olive, right? Like, black olives, purple olives, I don't know, half an egg, a third of an egg, it's a very strange, people are very confused by this topic, right? But, so, to make Seder out of this topic, to make Seder out of that, and say, we got together, we did a thorough investigation on this topic, and this is what we think, right? This is the Torah Eretz Yisrael on this topic. Such a thing would be, people would get people's attention, right? That's just a strategy. Yeah.
How would you form a Sanhedrin that's accepted by the different camps or families?
So that's part of the big lie that the powers that be are telling us every day in order to keep us divided and with our heads down. They want to make the impression that there's this tremendous strife in Klal Yisrael. Everyone is at each other's throats, and that there's no possibility of reconciliation or any type of unity whatsoever. And people require that. In order to make, there are certain people that require that in order to perpetuate their positions. Because if there's no strife, if there's no machlokas, if there's no battle, if there's no enemy, then there's no reason for them to have their positions of power and influence and prestige. Okay? But the reality is that there's probably no other time in Jewish history where there's been more Jewish unity and more people on the same page. Not just amongst the regular Amcha. I'm talking about Chachmei and Gedolei Yisrael. Okay? That there's communication between these people, and there's talking between them, and there's counsel, right? And what's the word? Consultations between them. The problem is that the people is that one of the things that makes someone a radical is their willingness to make a lot of noise. So the people that are calm, cool, and collective, and just going about their business and living their lives normally and trying to be productive and helpful, those people tend to be quiet, right? Because they're just doing stuff. They're just being productive and helpful. The people that are crazy and just want to watch everything burn so that they can have a place, you know, to put out the fire, they tend to be loud. So people get the impression, oh, well, all the noise that we're hearing is about, you know, all the machlokas and all the division, so that must be the case, right? But that's far from the reality. And again, I'm not saying that there's no machlokas and there's no issues to work out and there's no, right, even on fundamental issues, right? Fundamental issues, for sure. For sure there's a lot to be worked out. But the place for making such a unified project is certainly there. And again, as we progress more and more, I think we're going to get to a critical mass where the availability of information and the transparency in the world of Torah hits such a place that it will just be an organic demand that Chachmei Yisrael get together and make some type of a cohesive body. I think that's the direction that we're headed in. You go online, Rabosai, and see these incredible, you know, forums, Forum Otzer HaChachma, if people are familiar with, Forum B'Chadrei Chadarim. Scholars, like, from all over the world, they're communicating and working out these complicated questions, whether it's in history or in Kabbalah or in, you know, obscure areas of Halacha. People are getting together. People are talking. People are really, just people that are, you know, good faith. They just want to get to the bottom of things. They want to get answers. And there's a lot going on, right? And Baruch Hashem, right? Our mass communications technology are facilitating that. And hopefully we'll just continue in that direction. Yeah.
Why would people want to further these discrepancies?
So again, if I wasn't explicit enough, because there are vested interests of certain people. I'm sorry that you're smiling. I'm being very serious. Unfortunately, I'm being serious. There are people with vested interests in order that their position is dependent on there being continued strife because they've positioned themselves as the opposition to something, right? So if the opposition doesn't exist, then there's no reason for them, like, they don't have a job, basically, right? So, right, if your whole brand is I'm opposing this, then that thing needs to exist. It better not go away. The problem that you're screaming about, you actually want to. I'm not saying you. I'm saying the problem that they're screaming about, they actually, ironically, want it to stay that way forever. Okay, all the people complaining about, like, the, you know, the poisonous culture and the hefkeros and all that, and all of it is true, right? There's, for sure, there's a lot of Hefkeris out there, and the culture is poisonous, but secretly, they want it to continue, a lot of them, I'm not saying all of them, say many of them, the loudest ones, actually want it to continue more than everyone else. Because if, God forbid, one day, all of Hollywood would get up and say, you know what, guys, we've been a little bit too Hefker on the content that we've been putting out there, we're going to try to tone it down a little bit. If, God forbid, ever that happened, they would be out of a job, right? I'm giving you a very, like, crass and, you know, like, simplistic example, but I think you get the point, right? It's like the pathology of the nonprofit gone wild, right? Nonprofits, their business model is based on a problem existing. That's essentially what, right? It's like the opposite of regular businesses. Businesses are there because they succeed to the extent that they make problems go away. That's the measurement of their success. But nonprofits, the second that they solve a problem, that's it. They're out of business, right? And obviously, there's a similar dynamic in other professions. Doctors require sick people, and, you know, lawyers require divorces and all these horrible things. It's true. There's a similar dynamic with everything. But in terms of how they operate, right, there's a difference with a company that's, right, being explicit, like, this is why I'm here. I'm here to solve a problem, right? So they're measured by their ability to solve that problem. Masha Ein Kein, by people who they position themselves as the opposition to a problem. That's the critical distinction. Am I here to solve a problem, or am I here to oppose a problem? So people who are there to oppose a problem, they want the problem to exist. Even if they're not consciously willing to admit that, unfortunately, that's the reality. Yeah. Sorry if I scared you too much. It's best that you hear it from me now and you find out later.
You were talking before about, like, the Hagim of Minhag Makom. Does that exist today in place of Eretz Yisrael?
For sure. There are, for sure. There are certain things. Yes, there are certain things of Minhag Yerushalayim. Are there such things as Minhag Eretz Yisrael? That's a little, I don't know. Maybe there could be. I'm not familiar with them. But for sure, Minhagei Yerushalayim there are. But they tend to be in relatively obscure areas. For example, there is the Minhagim of the Chavrei Kedisha, right? Lo Aleinu in Yerushalayim about how they deal with the mace, about the tahara process, how they go about how they go about the burial, right? Right. I would say, actually, that's probably a good example, and I don't want to say this definitively because I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that that there is a minhag Eretz Yisrael to not use an arum.
Right.
Yeah.
As I was thinking.
Yeah. So is that a question? Is that a minhag ad kedei kach that it's forbidden to do something else? It's a good question. I don't know, but I have yet to see anyone do not like that in Eretz Yisrael.
Just Shabbos times and things like that.
Also with Nisuin, there are certain things about Nisuin, like when the chuppah is done in relation to the kiddushin, like things like that. But again, they tend to also the nosach of the ksuba. That's also something. Well, again, these are relatively trivial or technical details, but. That's the point. They tend to come up in more technical areas as opposed to like yom yom. Like for example, the tefillin on Chol HaMoed. We were talking about that last night.
Oh, yeah,
some guys. You know, the Prushim, the Talmidei Hagra that came here, they all like none of them wore tefillin on Chol HaMoed. But with the influx of more and more people into Yerushalayim, into Eretz Yisrael at large, I don't think anyone can say that there's a minhag in some place in Eretz Yisrael to wear tefillin or not wear tefillin. And even that, it would be difficult to say that that's a minhag, because in the end of the day, it's a halachic question, right? Maybe you could say that if you are going to wear tefillin, then you shouldn't wear tefillin openly in a place where the practice is not to. But that's not strictly a minhag question, it's more of a halachic question. Yeah.
Technology is like something a lot of people talk about. How should we use technology? Like a lot of people are giving up all the technology they have. So like, and but also causes a lot of issues. How should we relate to technology in like a general sense?
I might ask you to be a little bit more specific, because there's a lot of nafkaminas in there. Like, you're talking about communications technology, you're talking about like what type of technology?
Communications technology that people look like it's beneficial, but like you also waste your time on it, besides the pretext and that, but like
yeah. I think that being aware of that problem is already half the battle. We were talking a second ago about the vested interest thing. that like when a person uses these platforms, I have to understand like the business model of these platforms is based on you using it, right? So like what they say in marketing, if you're not buying the product, you are the product. Yeah. So you using these things, you are selling yourself essentially. Which okay, a person might want to say that they're willing to participate in the system in order to be able to reap the benefits of the system. That's fine. But to like what extent? And to understand that also, you know, you're being manipulated in order to do this. I'm working now with there's a company that we're working with now in Tel Aviv called Vendict, which are at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, an area, I think I spoke to this, I think I mentioned this in one of the chaburas. The cutting edge of artificial intelligence today is a field called NLP, natural language processing. And basically, these are machines that are able to understand human language and apply it in different contexts, like in an automated way, which is unbelievable. And what they've already been able to do is really interesting. But some of the bigger picture projects that these people are working on is to try to bring a sense of accountability to AI programmers, because all of data science today is basically AI. Like there's no really no data science going on that isn't connected to AI in some way. So how would they do that? So there's different methods. Some of it is. Like maybe you guys have heard of like the open source code to be able to see like what the programs are designed to do, right? There's issues with that, because once you make the program open source and people can copy it, you lose your rights to it, et cetera, et cetera. But different measures to keep accountability for people to see what it is that they're trying to accomplish with these programs. Yeah, I'm sure you guys have heard a lot of bad stuff about TikTok. One of the conversations that I had with one of these guys, I said, "So what do you have to say about TikTok?" He said, "Yeah, it's all true. In fact, it's much worse than people say. It's like it was designed by psychologists essentially that were hired in order to tweak and optimize the program to get you to be as fixed as possible And not even in like the more subtle ways that the legacy platforms like Facebook and Twitter are doing it. But like, you know, Mamish, you know, it doesn't matter if the thing has any content to it or not. It's just like, what is going to catch your attention for the next 2 seconds? Like, that's really all it comes down to. Yeah, like the measurable consequences that we're experiencing from this, just this platform alone, right? Leave it to the... leave it to the soulless Chinese to produce something like this, but no, it's really terrible. We have to be able to like understand what it is that we're putting into motion, yeah. But for the user, like for the individual user that we decide to to implement these tools or not implement them. So again, I think that being aware of it is already half the battle. And then there are different tools and methods that people can use in order to limit their exposure to these things. There's a great app that just came out recently. I thought it was very interesting. I personally don't use it because I don't feel a need to. But I found the idea very interesting. It's called Minimalist Phone. A brilliant idea. Basically, that you open your phone. You've heard about this, yeah? Basically, you open your phone and the screen is empty. There's no icons on your screen. So if you want to go to an app, you can go to your app. You just have to open up the settings and like scroll down to that particular app. It's not just sitting on your home screen, right? Just deploying this, it decreases the use of all apps, not just social media apps, but all apps by like, I don't know, like, you know, 45, 50%. It's unbelievable. Because most of it is compulsive. Most of the use is just compulsive, yeah? Impulsive, yeah? So again, just being aware of these things is already, I think, half the battle, and then you need to decide like what are the boundaries that we want to stick with, and self awareness. In the end of the day, self awareness is the biggest. It's the only thing that we have, because there's no fail proof method to approaching these things. Self awareness is always what has to be there, and when we have that self awareness, we sense that we're getting too drawn into something. We have to take a step back. All right, that's the way to go. Because again, there's no fail-proof method. There's no fail-proof tool. Yeah.
To what extent in halakha is halakha practice decided by like central planning and like consensus, or like individual opinions that are just adopted over time, not randomly, but just get adopted over time?
That's a really good question. Listen, there's the formal, you know. The formal method of the Sanhedrin, which is based on, you know, Achrei Rabin Lahatos. They take a vote, and if 35 say no and 36 say yes, then the answer is yes, right? So that's like one track. But not every decision that we make was something that was posed to the Sanhedrin for a psak, right? Gemara, there's many examples of this, but just one example of like a das yachid that tends to be adopted a lot, right? Right. Mishnas Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. All the teachings of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov are kav v'naki, are very precise and they're very clean, they're very understandable. So basically, when that Tana makes a comment, so we basically follow him, right? Halacha k'Rabbi Akiva mechavero. These things, was every single machlokas Rabbi Akiva and Chacham imposed to a Sanhedrin? I don't think so. Right, the Yerushalmi says famously, right, in all matters of halacha, puk chaze ma'amadvar, right? You should go out and look what the people are doing. So if there's no formal decision that was made by a Sanhedrin or by a Beis Din or something like that, then going and seeing the practice of people is a good rule of thumb. I'm not sure how useful that could be nowadays when you have like such a wide spectrum of opinion, but you know, at least it's within a spectrum. Like for instance, no one's eating cheese and chicken today, right? Like back in the day, there were people that did that, right? That was like an acceptable practice. Like now, that's outside of the Overton window, so to speak. That's not an acceptable position. Yeah. I hope that gave at least something to go with. I think that just to make it more concise, I think that both of those options are possible. There could be a top-down decision, which in a technical sense we haven't really had since the Sanhedrin. That's one option. So that would be the top-down, centralized version. But the more organic version is just, you know, the practice of the Jewish people over time, how it develops. That's a more, you know, organic way of... of halachic practice being determined, and that's the pokaze ma'am advar. Go out and see what people are doing.
Yeah. To what extent do you think that halachic decision making is active or reactive?
That's a really good question. Clearly a lot of the gezeros that Chazal are making are in response to a certain situation, right? There are many gezeros that Chazal codified in a more formalized way that have their origins in earlier times of history. A really good example is the gezera on Stam Yenam, right? Stam Yenam was codified into its current form by the Chachmei HaMishnah, okay? But the gezera originated with who? With Pinchas ben Elazar. Pinchas ben Elazar was the first one to be gozer on Yayin Akum in reaction to what? In reaction to the Benos Moab incident. Yeah? So clearly it was in a response to this thing. Yeah? Now again, if something is completely reactionary, it tends to peter out. It tends to like dissipate over time because the thing is the whole basis for it is becomes no longer relevant. And that's the whole idea that Chazal took that original gezera of Pinchas and codified it into a more halachic framework because it did remain relevant. I think for sure, using the term reactionary already gives it a negative connotation. I think that a more fair approach would be that the Chachamim try to look at the Metzius and address it according to how they see it. Demai is a really good example, right? Demai is the gezera that if you have produce that comes from a non-trustworthy person, then you have to assume that maestros weren't taken from it. Not truma, right? But maestros weren't taken from it. And therefore, it still has a semi-status of tevel, and you have to take meiser from it misafik. That was a gezera, okay? But the Gemara says, in a few places, that subsequent to that gezera, they did some type of a survey. They sent out people, and they saw that rov amei ha'aretzos ma'asrim tivleim. I think that's the lashon over there. That most people, even if they're not learned, they still take meisros. They saw that really the basis of it wasn't really applicable anymore, and that has nafkaminas lahalacha, that there are kulas regarding demai that didn't exist before, because they saw that practically speaking, right, that it's still going. Ah, yishar kach. I think we're gonna have to wrap it up soon, anyways. It's 12 o'clock, but yishar kach. Yeah.
How do you approach the significance of Lashon HaKodesh, especially related to the letters themselves and numerical values?
So. Lashon HaKodesh, first of all, just to understand the meaning of that term itself, Lashon HaKodesh. People often translate the term Lashon HaKodesh as the holy tongue, right? Like the holy language. But that translation is incorrect for a very simple reason, because the word Kodesh in Lashon HaKodesh doesn't mean holy the adjective, it means holy the noun, Kodesh, right? Kadosh is an adjective, right? Kodesh is a noun. So what that means is, when we say Lashon HaKodesh, it's kind of like scientific annotation. There's nothing scientific about the annotation. Right? The annotation itself isn't scientific. Rather, this is the annotation that you use when you're dealing with science. There's also engineering annotation, by the way, right? That engineer, it's a specific type of annotation for engineering. There's nothing engineering about the marks on the page. It's saying when you're dealing with this topic, this is what you use. So similarly, in Lashon HaKodesh, what that means is this is the language that you use when you're talking about the dimension of holiness. That's what that means. Okay? That's Lashon HaKodesh. Now, Chazal themselves identified Lashon HaKodesh as central to Jewish education, right? It says, this is the Sifri in Parshas Ha'azinu. It says that the moment that a child is able to speak, right, his father is obligated to teach him Lashon HaKodesh. Yeah, and in the Sifri earlier on in Akev, if I'm not mistaken, right, it's a statement of Rav Meir. Kol HaKorei Kriya Shema Medaber B'Lashon HaKodesh Muftach Lo Shu Ben Olam Haba. Okay, excuse me. Kol Hadar Be'Eretz Yisrael V'Korei Kriya Shema Medaber B'Lashon HaKodesh. Those are the three things. Those three things, a person is guaranteed to the world to come. So, to speak in Lashon HaKodesh is not a, right? This is a central thing. The Ramban in Sefer Bereishis says that which the Lashon HaKodesh is called Lashon HaKodesh is because this, right, Zeh HaLashon Shedibar HaKodesh Baruch Hu Im HaAvos, this is the language that God used to communicate with the Avos, Ubezeh Nivru Shamayim Ma'aretz, and this is the language that was used to create, to generate the world into being, right? The whole point of the Maaseh Bereishis story is that how are things created? By precise speech. That's how they're created. Things are created by focused, conscious speech. That's how things are created. That yisod is, you know, you can think about that just that yisod for a lifetime. But the speech has to be Lashon HaKodesh, right? And Chazal used that term interchangeably to describe a mode, a modality of communication, and a specific language, i.e. Hebrew. Okay, why is that? Because Hebrew is the language in its structure and its nuances and its syntax and right, and all of its grammatical rules is the most suited to function in that way. Right? And it's, again, this is the language that God himself used, so to speak, to communicate with the Avos and all the other Nevi'im. So that's the significance of Lashon HaKodesh, just the language itself. And obviously there's more to say, but I think that's a good summary. In terms of the osios, so in the Yushal, there's a sugya in Masechah Shabbos, in regarding the way that the letters on the luchos were positioned. Okay, so the Bavli in Shabbos says that mem shabaluchos menes hayatoloi, right? The mem, right? The ksav on the luchos was bored all the way through, like from one end to the other. Okay, so if that's true, then if you have a mem suma, then that means that there's like a piece of luchos that's just hanging, right? It's suspended in the air, like by a miracle. Okay. In the Yerushalmi, it brings an opinion that is cholek on that, and that opinion is essentially that the ksav and the luchos was what is known as today as ksav ivri, okay. Now, even today, if you go right over here to the Kotel, you can find, we have archaeological ruins that have ksav ivri on them. Yeah? Not Ashuris, ksav ivri. With like the lines. It looks similar to that, yeah, it does. Yeah, so the alphabet, and it's clearly this was an alphabet that was used. However, the fact that there exists such an alternative alphabet. Oh, it's worth mentioning also that the Rambam in his Perush HaMishnayos in Avos says explicitly that the Ksav Ashuris, and this is the rationalist Rambam speaking, that the Ksav Ashuris is the authentic like alphabet and the Tzuras HaOsios of like actual real Lashon HaKodesh. Yeah, I forget exactly the context in which he brings that up right now, and I'm sorry that I'm forgetting that, but that's basically more or less what he says. The fact that there is another, written language, you know, that's a common occurrence, not just in other cultures, but also in Klal Yisrael itself, right? Ksav, right? The ksav that's commonly known as Ksav Rashi, right? That's an alternative ksav that was developed by people because, you know, how they ended up writing the letters. And there's a whole thing, there's a whole, like, history about how, you know, it's not the etymology, but, like the historical development of how Ksav Rashi came to be. It's an interesting topic in and of itself. But the point that I'm making is that there are Ksavim, there are certain types of script that emerge organically from a culture when people write. Okay? So just because there's an alternative, and I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not saying that Ksav Ivri, you know, emerged from Ksav Ashuris or vice versa. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that there are always alternative scripts. Very often, not always, very often alternative scripts that exist, even though there's one language in a culture, okay? So the fact that there's these alternatives doesn't negate the chashivos of Ashuris. That's all I'm trying to say. But clearly, Ksav Ivri was commonly used, like, a lot. You know, even in the Bayashani period, it was used quite a bit. And Ksav Ashuris seems to be, like, what was used for more, you know, more... official or religious, it's not even official, because even the official stuff use Ksav Ivri, but like in a religious context, like, you know, when writing a Sefer Torah, for instance. So, yeah. We might have to wrap it up after this question. Any more? Yeah, go ahead.
related to the technology question, what do you think about like Facebook soon, like metaverse or whatever? You think
that? Oh yeah. Oh my God, that's terrible. Yeah, it's really. I mean, listen.
Are you talking about VR stuff?
What?
Totally virtual reality.
That's the yeah. That's VR.
Yeah.
That's
VR. Chabad.
VR and well, I mean, at this point, it's VR and AR. AR, augmented reality. But I mean, it's all it's. Listen, there's this. You know, there's this contemporary philosopher named Ken Wilber. He's actually still alive. He lives in Colorado, if I'm not mistaken. He's been around forever. Very, very interesting guy. I used to be. I had like a period where I was, you know, very, very into his, very into his stuff. He wrote a book years ago, like a novel, okay, called Boomeritis. Boomeritis, like the boomers, like, you know, like the baby boomer generation. Okay, so boomeritis, like, you know, the disease of that generation. Okay. Yeah, it's a very difficult book to read. It's like very, very dark and very. It's just very. It's just very terrible. I had to put it down at a certain point. But basically, the running theme throughout the book is that the new generation, like essentially the millennials, I guess, this is a 30-year-old book. Okay, they're trying to introduce technology that could transport a person's consciousness out of their body. That you could just live on a computer. Okay, that was like the running theme throughout the. And like all the kids are like these, you know, nihilistic, anti-establishment type of thing. This is back in the day where this wasn't a cliche quite yet, okay? But that's the running theme, that they're all trying to get out of their bodies. They're all trying to like jump to the cloud, okay? This is before the concept of a cloud existed. But the point is that the degradation of a civilization is marked by many things, but one of the things that it's marked by is a desire to become completely disembodied, to become completely ethereal. This is another thing that we did in the Maharal Chabura over here, and excuse me, we didn't do this in the Maharal Chabura, but it is in Derech Chaim, it is in the Maharal on Avos. He says that, he asked the question in the Mishnah, Asara Doros mi Avram v'ad Noach, that there were 10 generations from Avram until Noach, and they were all wicked. Every single one of them was wicked. So says the Maharal, Adam HaRishon, you know, was Godol Shebegedolim, right? The Gemara in Chagiga says he saw from one end of the world to the other. The Gemara in Baba Basra says that Reish Lakish was demarcating the graves, and he saw the heel of the dead body of Adam HaRishon, right? V'haya oro makeinov kegalgal chama. It blinded him like looking at the sun. So Adam HaRishon is this incredibly sublime, being. How could it be that all the generations from Adam to Noah were like these terrible, corrupt, you know, completely irredeemably wicked people? And he says something shocking, which you would—it's just like comes out of left field. You would not expect this answer. But he says the reason that they were all wicked is because they had weak bodies. What does that mean? It means that Adam HaRishon's body was designed to be a body that was completely, completely subservient to the spiritual domain of the person, the spiritual attributes, rather, of the person. And the body wasn't so essential, okay? It was a very weak body, because all the body was just, you know, kind of slapped on to the soul. In fact, I think we mentioned this a while ago, the Meiri, at the end of Masechet Shabbos, on Daf Samach Aleph, if I'm not mistaken, says that this is the source of the practice to look at the fire of the Havdalah in your fingernails. You don't have to do that, Maker Hadin. Just looking at the fire itself, just looking at it. In the end of the day, it's a Birkas Hariyah, right? It's seeing something. So if you see it, you make the bracha. But what's this thing looking in the fingernails? So says the Meiri, because he says prior to the fall of Adam HaRishon, the body was translucent like the fingernails. The whole body was translucent like the fingernails. So to remember, to have a throwback to what that was, because the whole source of the Ner Havdalah is, as the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar says, excuse me, it's not Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, it's the Bavli and Psachim. It says that Adam Harishon, on the first Motzei Shabbos, when the light of Shabbos went out, so he said, I need to create my own fire, right? The Nizr Kabodas, Kedas Elyo, and he had divine, you know, inspiration, and he said, you know, he took two rocks together, and he pounded them together, and the sparks came out, and he lit the fire, yeah? So since the whole thing is a throwback to Adam Harishon and his fall from a sublime spiritual level to a lower level, so we look at the fingernails to remember how the body was at a different state of humanity. Fine, that's all in parentheses. The point is that the Maharal says is that the reason that they were all incorruptibly wicked is that the body was weak, and because the body was weak, it wasn't able to be integrated into Avodas Hashem, into authentic spirituality, and therefore they just went completely off the rails. And it took until Avraham to have that the side of the body, meaning the animal side of the human being, could develop and mature enough that it could be an expression to the ruchnius of the neshama. But it requires a significant, right? It requires that. Right? The body needs to be developed. If there's not a healthy body, and healthy I don't mean not sick, healthy I mean developed and strong, okay, that gives proper expression to the inner dimension of the person, okay, that produces shleimus. Otherwise, right, there are big problems with that. Okay?
Is that evolution?
Huh?
Is that evolution?
Is that like Darwinian evolution?
Yeah.
It's not Darwinian evolution, no. It's this is a much smaller process than Darwinian evolution. Darwinian evolution takes, you know, millions of years. This is something that takes, you know, 10 or a few generations. This can be engineered, and like Lo Aleinu, there are cultures that they engineer like the classes of their society to have weak bodies in order so that they'll remain like weak and subservient. I mean, this sounds like nightmarish, but this is like what goes on in India and in the caste system in India. Different places in India enforce this more stringently than others, but like there are castes, they're not allowed to eat meat. They're not allowed to eat meat. They can eat like vegetables and garlic, and that's it. Why? Because such a diet, it stunts not just your physical growth, but your intellectual capacity. Right? It's one of the reasons, by the way, they say this, and this is a hard, I don't say this humorously, but like in Indonesia, it was recently highlighted a very, very big problem of like lack of childhood cognitive development. And this is attributed to the fact that it's a huge staple of their diet to have processed fried dough. Like, you know, in like Oriental food, like, you know, like egg rolls and noodles and all that stuff. It's like dough that's fried and processed. That's like the staple of their diet. So not only is that terrible for like your chances at making the track team, but it also like really, really messes up your ability to develop your brain. Because your brain is an organ like all the other organs of your body. So if your physical brain isn't functioning, you're gonna have a hard time thinking. This is really, really sad. Sometimes this is done by accident, like in Indonesia, right? Sometimes it's done intentionally. It's really, really horrible. So this can be done like within the course of like a few generations. This is not Darwin. This is not like survival of the fittest and, you know, random mutations and all that. This is something that, you know, can happen much quicker than that. The point that I'm trying to make is that a healthy, strong body is essential to be able to have a shleimus, not only for Shmiras HaTorah, right? This is before the Torah. Right? We're talking about the generations of Avram, you know, and before Avram, they're obviously before the Torah. This is just to have shleimus as a human being, okay? So this whole idea, right, this new idea, like somehow, you know, if we can escape the body, then I'll make things better, is like totally, totally off kilter. If this kicks off in any, like, serious way, this is going to have profound, profound repercussions on civilization. And I don't mean to sound like alarmist, but this is what it is, okay? If like augmented reality and virtual reality become like staples of the experience of people, it can have profound, profound repercussions on people's mental health, on people's ability to function, people's ability to engage in the real world. It's going to be really, really bad. And the times of people say, oh, well, we're already living so much on the screens, and yes, we're doing it, but we're talking about a qualitative. First of all, we can see already the damage that's coming from that. We can quantify the damage that's being done from that already, right? But this is a qualitative jump even beyond that, okay? So again, it all comes from this pathological yearning to escape the body. Where, contrary to what many, you know, frum people would like to think, you know, people that are, you know, the frumt people, you know, escaping the body is ideal, obviously, right? The body's bad. No. The whole point is to harness. It's to harness the body. It's to purify the body, right? Like we discussed last night, right? Begadecha leveinim means that you can actually, you know, transform that domain into something that is totally in line with a higher thing. And you can't you know, push that to the side or try to escape from it, because it will only produce dysfunction and increased suffering and death. So don't do that. Yeah, sorry to end on such a bleak note. Yeah, I'm sorry to end on such a happy note, but that's what. Tov, shkarach, guys. It's a paradox that.